This is a 720 to go podcast from Chicago's WGN Radio 720.
This podcast is sponsored by ADM.
As one of the world's largest agricultural processors, ADM is uniquely positioned to serve the world's growing needs for abundant food and renewable energy. ADM.
When it comes to the business of America's farmland, you need the information from the people who know it best. That's why we bring you AgriCast with Orion Samuelson and Max Armstrong.
Thank you very much, Roger, and good morning. And not quite as much rain falling in the desert as in the Midwest, but we have been getting the monsoon rains in the desert in Scottsdale, Arizona, and up in Cottonwood, up near Sedona, where we spent a day this week visiting with cattlemen and ranchers who are a little concerned about what's happening with the cattle market, and probably will be even more concerned after the cattle on feed report for the month that was issued yesterday. It's been called a bearish report. We'll get into that just a little bit later. And of course, we'll talk weather and grain markets with Dale Durkholz stopping by to visit with Max Armstrong a little bit later. But our topic to begin the show today, sweet corn. When will the locally grown MeRai sweet corn be ready to come onto the market? Well, maybe sooner than you think. But we'll talk to Gary Pack, who is our man at Twin Garden Farms in Harvard, Illinois, about that subject when we continue here on the Saturday Morning Show. Well, we go directly to the source to get the answer, Gary Pack, Twin Garden Farms in Harvard, Illinois. Good morning, Gary. Good to have you with us.
Same here, Orion. Good morning to you. It's time.
Well, I tell you what, with all of the weather we've been watching moving across, particularly northern Illinois, what kind of an impact is it having on sweet corn?
Well, we're really fortunate in Harvard right now. We've been getting the rains, but not the deluges that they've gotten north and south of us. So the MeRai sweet corn is in really good shape. The seed is in good shape. We have to fight some mud, but we're really fortunate. What set us back was a cold spring.
And, of course, I noticed on your website now you're putting a sweet corn countdown. So here on Saturday morning, how many days are we away from MeRai on the market?
Well, I think we're going to be able to get going next weekend. And I just got the report from Cliff. He checked the field this morning, and it's always, you know, we always say startups and shutdowns are hard to estimate, but we'll be getting opened up next weekend and getting the corn to the markets, and we'll be getting going.
Now, I remember the time when you could only buy corn at your stand on the farm just west of Harvard, but that has all changed. You're at farmers markets, and where can people find the information on MeRai corn at farmers markets?
We do the best we can to keep the website up to date. It's at twingardenfarms.com, and it would list the farmers markets, the days, the locations, and whether we have vegetables and MeRai sweet corn or just the MeRai sweet corn. So, and we're always glad to take the phone calls. But if you check the website, that will give you all the information for the markets.
So let's talk about this sweet corn crop. How many acres do you produce every year?
We do about 80 acres of sweet corn, the MeRai, just MeRai.
And the Japanese really love the MeRai corn. I recall being at your place several years ago when there were Japanese buyers visiting you to talk about MeRai.
Right. Yes, it has a Japanese name, which is a little bit of a misleading. It actually was developed in McHenry County, Illinois, and right here in Harvard. And yes, they love the sweet corn. They love the taste. They go for high quality food in Japan, and we've had a long standing relationship with them. And they took the first seed years ago, and it was a little bit hard to grow, so they actually put the name on it, and we kept the name because it is a little bit unique.
It really is. A lot of people ask me, what does it mean? I say it means the best tasting sweet corn you'll ever have.
Well, let's talk about that, and we believe that, but it means taste of the future.
Yes, we comparing sweet corn to field corn. Field corn you like to get planted within a matter of days so that the harvest will take place in a matter of days. But
yes.
Sweet corn is totally different because you have to harvest sweet corn how long? How many crops do you plant every spring?
There's about 30 different plantings of the Mirai sweet corn, and to make sure that when we can get started, we're 10 days late this year because of the cool spring, but normally we earn sweet corn for about 8 weeks, and we plant from the end of April till the first week of July, and there's about 30 plantings in that period.
And that way you're able to harvest over how long a period? When you're starting in July, how late will you harvest?
We'll probably go through September for the farmers markets. Usually the home market, when everybody gets back to school and the driving is done, we usually close Harvard, but we keep going to the farmers markets through the month of September with the sweet corn.
So now we go to the field corn, because I keep getting questions. How many acres of sweet corn do we produce in the United States as compared to the total acreage of field corn that we would produce here in this country?
It's a mind-boggling number, and we produce 90 million acres of field corn,
right?
Corn for cattle feed and for cornflakes and for oils and for many, many, many uses. I have a pen in my hand that's made from field corn, but there's 90 million acres, and the best kept numbers for sweet corn are 615,000 acres. Which is only 0.75% of the total corn acres in the country. Of that 615,000 acres, 190,000 is fresh and 425,000 is for processing.
So will the sweet corn go into canned corn or other means of marketing it?
Right. The 425,000 processed acres would go into to cans, yes, and frozen. Frozen's, I think, the preferred way nowadays. And, yes, and, you know, there's a lot of prepackaging being done, and it's the world of food nowadays is really, there's a lot of stuff going on.
Yeah. We ask this question every year, but give us your advice on preparing Mirai. How do you do it, and what do you suggest that consumers do?
Well, the first time out, if you haven't had Mirai, it's the best thing is just to boil it for 2 minutes. Get the water boiling, boil it for 2 minutes, and then leave the pot on, and 2 minutes later, you're going ahead. A lot of our customers, if you stand in line here at the farm, you'll talk sweet corn naturally, and they will talk about, oh, you don't need to cook it. You can eat it raw. We guaranteed in the refrigerator in the husk for over a week. It does not lose its sweetness, nor does it turn to starch, which is the normal situation. But with the three sweet corn genes that are in Mirai, it has a great shelf life. It kept refrigerated in the husk.
I have to bring up the situation several years ago when you had a guest come out to the farm that surprised you and actually surprised me. But Paul
yes.
Harvey
yes.
came out and spent time. Tell me about that one more time.
Yeah, Paul Harvey loved sweet corn, and you and he were talking in Chicago, I know, and he was wondering about this new Japanese sweet corn. So long story short, we ended up conversing, and he wanted to know the story, so I ended up in his office in Chicago on Michigan Avenue, and then he came to the farm. And I didn't really blow it up so that he would just be able to come and relax. He pulled in. He was 90 years old. He ended up sitting in our roadside market for a couple hours. And his voice, you know, whenever his voice was so recognizable, and people would just stop and turn, holy mackerel. And then we actually went out to the seed field. He wanted to see the seed field. We took his limousine to the seed field. And it was just I can't thank you enough, Oregon, for getting me hooked up with Paul. It was one of the neatest experiences and most humbling experiences of my life. It was just fantastic.
Well, it was fun for me because for years, whenever Paul would call me, because from time to time when he was doing farm stories, he would just want to check his facts and compare them with
sure.
my opinion, and so he'd call me. phone would ring in my office at WGN, and I'd pick it up and say, WGN, Orion speaking. And he would always say, good morning, American. And you knew right away who was on the line. But this particular day, he said, good morning, American. Talk to me about sweet corn. And so that really started the entire conversation that led to the visit to Twin Garden Farm. So
now, so it's such an amazing experience for us here at the farm.
Yeah, I'm sure it was. Let's talk about hours at the stand in Harvard, Illinois, for those who want to come out there and visit you there. When are you open?
We're open once we open, which is going to be Friday or Saturday. We're going to be open from 10 in the morning till 5 in the afternoon every day, 7 days a week.
And sweet corn will be, the Mi Rai will be available.
Yes, yes. We don't open in Harvard until we have sweet corn. We are going to farmers markets with some of our quality vegetables right now, but no sweet corn until maybe Thursday or Friday at the earliest.
And go to your website to find out which farmers markets you'll be offering Mi Rai sweet corn.
Yes, there's information for each one of the farmers markets or locations, because we do have a few small grocery stores that carry the Mi Rai sweet corn once we start.
Well, Gary, always a pleasure to visit with you. Always a pleasure to taste your product. I'm looking forward to getting back from Arizona in a week, just in time for the first batch of Mi Rai sweet corn. So continue to have a good year and don't flood away, please.
No, we're glad to have you back and travel safe. And no, it's great talking to you once again.
Gary Pack of Twin Garden Farms in Harvard, Illinois, here on the Saturday Morning Show. It is 26 minutes after 5 o'clock, Saturday Morning Show on a rainy morning around the Midwest, at least. Yesterday, after the market closed, the monthly cattle on feed report issued by the Department of Agriculture. A quick reaction, first impressions, bearish, huge placements, well above highest estimate. That means a bearish cattle market for the fall through winter of 2018. Neutral on the marketing, just 1% more than on feed. And with packers having captive supplies and contracts for August, traders don't see a lot of upside in that cattle market. So some of the numbers, the number of cattle on feed in the feedlots for processing, 10,800,000 head on the 1st of July. That was 4% above July 1st a year ago. And placements in feedlots during June totaled 1,770,000 head, 16% above a year ago. And during June, placements of cattle and calves weighing less than 600 pounds were at 375,000 head. Marketings of fed cattle during June, 1,990,000. That's 4% above a year ago. So the reaction by traders initially, and we'll wait, of course, till the market opens Monday to see what actually happens. But right now, it looks like a bearish opening for the cattle market on Monday with these numbers in the cattle on feed report. Don't know what's going on in China, because last month they agreed to take U.S. fresh beef into the country again, something they hadn't done since early in the century when we had the mad cow disease scare. So that happened with China agreeing to take beef last month. But on Thursday of this week, Secretary of Agriculture Sonny Perdue made the announcement that China officials have agreed to allow imports of U.S. rice for the first time ever in history. The move would give U.S. rice farmers access to the world's biggest rice consumer, with China importing about 5 million tons last year. But figures that USA Rice President Betsy Ward shared with us, we waited a decade for the protocol to be signed, and our members are anxious to meet the demand of China's consumers for safe, high-quality U.S. rice. And here's the number that blew me away. Betsy Ward said China consumes the equivalent of the entire U.S. rice crop every 13 days. That's eating a lot of rice, but rice growers in Arkansas and in the Gulf States and in California all looking forward to getting additional markets in the international trade for U.S. rice. Well, we're coming up to news time here on the Saturday Morning Show, and as always, we're delighted to have you along with us here on Chicago's very own WGN 720 and WGNradio.com. Oh, and if you're an Amazon Echo user, just say, play WGN Radio. At 5:30, here's Roger with the news.
Thank you, sir. Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker has declared a state of emergency in 17 western Wisconsin counties following torrential rains and flooding there. Between 6 and 8 inches of rain fell Wednesday night, causing flash floods and rivers to rise to major flood stage. More storms hit the area Friday night. Hundreds of people on the eastern Greek island of Kos have spent the night sleeping outdoors after a powerful earthquake killed 2 tourists and injured nearly 500 others across the Aegean Sea region in Greece and Turkey. U.S. Department of Justice says it's settled discrimination claims from 2 HIV patients who said physicians at a Milwaukee-based medical provider refused to treat them because of their illness. Settlement calls for Aurora Healthcare to pay $30,000 to one patient, $15,000 to another, and $15,000 civil penalty to the federal government. We'll check sports, traffic, and weather next on WGN.
And Roger, I'm looking at that radar across our area of the country in the Midwest. It is a pretty messy picture with a fair amount of yellow and red in the radar picture that we're getting. It extends all the way back into central Iowa and then comes across southern Wisconsin, northern Illinois, and then there's another area of yellow and red that's moving out of northern Indiana into northwestern Ohio. So it looks like there's going to continue to be rain and active thunderstorm activity. Checking that radar picture. Anyway, we're back with the Saturday Morning Show. Always delighted to have you along. And right now, it's time to say welcome to Samuelson Says, sponsored by Wink Products Company, makers of quality specialty cleaning products since 1947. I'm Orion Samuelson, and with one of the TV networks taking a look at living in the 90s in the United States, I'm going to take a look at eating in the 50s when I was a teenager. We'll do that right after we talk about the folks at Wink Products Company who want to help make your life easier with a family of professional strength cleaning products, products that really work. Wink Rust Stain Remover is the number one liquid rust stain remover in the country. And this professional strength formula dissolves those ugly rust stains on white sinks and toilet bowls, color-fast fabrics and carpets. The little round bottle has been around since 1947, and it's still number one. To learn where to find quality Wink products, check us out at wink.com, that's WHINK.com. I admit I'm not the biggest fan of social media because the one thing that bothers me is the fact that anybody can put anything on social media, true or false, but somewhere some people will read it and believe it. So I'm not that big a fan, but once in a while I do come across an item on the internet that does get my attention. And that's what I'm talking about today. With the one of the TV channels doing the series on living in the 90s in the United States, I recently came across a posting on the internet that said eating in the 50s. Well, that's when I was a teenager. So let me share with you what eating was like in the 50s. In the United States, pasta had not been invented. It was macaroni or spaghetti. Curry was a surname. Taco, never saw one till I was 15. Pizza sounds like a leaning tower somewhere. Bananas and oranges only appeared at Christmas time. All chips were plain. Oil was for lubricating, fat was for cooking. Tea was made in a teapot using tea leaves and never green. Chickens didn't have fingers in those days, and none of us had ever heard of yogurt. Healthy food consisted of anything edible. Cooking outside was called camping. Seaweed was not a recognized food. Kebab was not even a word, never mind a food. Sugar enjoyed a good press in those days and was regarded as being white gold. Prunes were medicinal and stewed. Surprisingly, muesli was readily available. We called it cattle feed. Pineapples came in chunks or were round with a hole in the middle in a tin, and we had only ever seen a picture of a real one. Water came out of the tap. If someone had suggested bottling it and charging more than gasoline for it, they would have become a laughingstock. And there were three things that we never, ever had on or at our table in the 50s. Elbows, hats, and cell phones. And there was always two choices for each meal. Take it or leave it. Eating in the 50s. I remember a lot of those events as I'd sit down at the supper table and the dinner table and the breakfast table on the farm in Wisconsin. That's Samuelson Says, a presentation of Tribune Radio Networks. Max Armstrong standing by to talk weather and impact on markets with his guest when we continue here on the Saturday Morning Show.
Dale Durko's AgriVisor joining us in the studio this weekend. Now, I was thinking about this the other morning. Seasoned veterans such as yourself, when you get into these days in July and a weather market is potentially heating up, Do you get up during the night? Do you find it difficult to sleep all night? Do you get up and check the market to see if, okay, this is the point where we've rounded the corner and the market is heating up now?
You know, ever since we started overnight trading, at about 11 o'clock midnight, I go to bed and I wake up the next morning at 6 o'clock. Whatever happens, happens.
I had a feeling that was going to be the answer. Now, if you were 22 or 32, it might be a different story.
Maybe, but you know, you really have to learn to let it go, or we really deal with markets 24 hours a day. You just have to say, my mind needs to relax. It needs to set it aside. I need to get my rest, and you do it.
I noticed the drought monitor map when it came out Thursday morning showed that, yes, the drought is spreading. Just as I think some of us expected, it's getting a little more severe in the areas that have already been in drought, and then the dryness seems to be reaching out a little farther through areas of the Corn Belt. Not a big wide sweep, but these little tentacles, it seems, that are extending.
You know, the year that comes to mind when I think about this year is 1995. We had a period in 95 where it got real hot in the middle of July for about a 4 to 5 day span, moderated a little bit, moisture a little above, a little below normal, depending on where you were at. August, a little warm, but again, not bad. But again, yield that year ended up being about 10% under trend. And really what happened, we got hot at the wrong time, impacted pollination. And if you look at what's going on this week with the kind of heat, you really ask those same questions again.
The forecast going forward is critical, isn't it, over the next couple of weeks?
It really is. You know, the heat this week is, or this last week, is really a problem. You know, now looking forward at this point, it's going to be what kind of temperatures do we have to follow up, number one. But just as important, what kind of moisture are we going to have follow up because of the expanding dry area we're starting to see across the Midwest?
We have seen some storms. We've seen them firing up in individual instances, but the coverage isn't good enough.
They can send them my way. You know, if you look at it, this last week, you know, it ended up southern Minnesota right into the northeastern part of Iowa, across Wisconsin, northern Illinois, then dipped into Indiana. But you go south of that, it's basically been the popcorn showers that have popped up, not widespread coverage. And that's really what you got to be careful about.
There's also been a little storm damage that's come along with it, but that's always the case. I mean, that tends to be kind of isolated, but boy, the social media really amps that up, it seems, because guys will show us the size of the hailstones in their fields.
Social media amps everything up. This last week, I saw a guy down in Salem, Illinois. He had laid out some ears of corn across the tailgate of a pickup truck, and he had talked about where they had pollinated here about 2 weeks ago and where they were today, and about a third of the ear was tipped back. It basically had aborted kernels already.
Do you think the market has accounted for all of these problems? The difficulty in the eastern Corn Belt because of too much moisture, the challenges of the dryness in the western Corn Belt. Are we trading yet the right corn yield?
No. Next answer. You know, really, if you go back and you look at it, I mentioned 1995. And as I remember here, we started out with a yield on the August crop report, I want to say around 126 bushels to the acre, somewhere close to trend. We ended up at 113, and it was through those series of crop reports we kept realizing the summer weather was really more problematic than we thought. I think the same thing happens this year, and what you end up with is a market like 1995 where you really start to get your elevation in prices during the fall period. That's like 1980. It's like 1983. So I don't think the market's really adjusted to any of this yet.
Now, listen, you're comparing with 95. I mean, you're going back 22 years in your comparison. Oh, we have these giant yielding hybrids, these amazing resilient hybrids that have the ability to shake off all of this stress, don't we?
Everything's relative. The thing that people need to understand is where we are in terms of trend yield. We go back to 1995, we were around 125, 126. Trend yield today is 170. You know, I took a look, there was a fellow at Michigan State University one time, to make a long story short. He was looking at the 74 drought of all things, but he was comparing the actual yield back to what the trend was at that point. It was really the same as what we had back in those two droughts back in the 30s. So was 1983, and so was 1988, and as was 2012. So it's all relative to what that trend is.
Well, now, you made mention of the mid-70s, and I remember that year we had a lot of very late crop acreage. I was stunned a week ago while driving through parts of Illinois, northern and central Illinois, looking at how short some of the corn is and how very short some of the soybeans are. We need a full growing season in those areas, don't we?
Especially when you go to the east, central Illinois and to the east. You know, you're really getting to a point where we ended up with an awful lot of replant corn. I actually saw a field of corn picture in Ohio this last week. It was about mid-calf high. You know, I mean, because it had been replanted so many times. And yes, where we had all these planting delays, we got some real issues. 1974 was one of those years where we planted late. Although we did get part of the crop in good timeliness, we needed a long growing season. 74, we didn't get it because that was also the year we had the early frost.
That's why I brought you back to that comparison. I remember it vividly, visiting at the time with then-Secretary of Agriculture Earl Butz, and we were in the midst of selling grain in a grand scheme to the old Soviet Union. Well, now, let's talk about that overseas demand. Is there the possibility that overseas buyers will get a little bit concerned about what's going on here and want to make sure that their supplies are booked?
You know, that's the one thing people don't really think about. When you look at two grains in particular, wheat or corn, you really need to look at those worldwide grain structures minus China to start to appreciate where the available supply is. If we really impact our corn crop this year, we're going to find that pretty quickly things start to tighten up. People are going to get anxious, coupled up with the fact we've got another situation that has developed this year. Wheat isn't as competitive with corn in the feed bunk as what it used to be either. So that base corn demand, and we need a big corn crop. Otherwise, buyers are going to get anxious about what kind of supplies they'll have.
That's an interesting point, the ready availability of the wheat isn't quite to what it was. I mean, simply because it's priced out of that business of being a substitute for corn.
And that's the real key. It's really priced itself out of the feed bunk relative to the corn at this point. We've got enough wheat around the world, that isn't going to be a problem unless we want to talk about the high protein. But it's just the fact that we've elevated that wheat price relative to corn so it doesn't compete with corn, and that helps corn demand on a worldwide basis.
The corn carryout number, though, still looks pretty big, doesn't it?
At this point, it looks big if you're up around 2.2 billion bushel. But as I told people, you know, if you go back in and say if you have a, instead of a 170 on the USDA balance sheet, you go to a 165. Let's take 5 bushel off. We take 5 bushel off, we go from a 2.2 to a 1.8. Now, if we go down and let's say go into the to the low 160s, you start marching back all the way into the 1.5, maybe 1.4 area. And gosh, you know, if you talk about a true drought is always explained, yields are 10% below trend. So you're basically talking about 153 bushel yield. And then if you start going that low, you're talking about going all the way back to a potentially a billion bushel carryout, even though you're going to have to ratchet down your demand base. So weather is still a big story here for the next 6 to 8 weeks.
Knowing what the supplies were, are, from the crops in South America, is it likely there's going to be a substantial movement of South American grain into the southeast U.S.? Substantial might be overblowing it a little bit, but will we see significant cargoes coming into the United States simply because of the deficit of the eastern corn belt U.S. and the ready availability of supplies from South America?
That really is going to be the key. It's what kind of crop we have in the eastern corn belt that's readily available to go down into the southeast itself. And then you get into the mix of what are the basic price differentials, what's the transportation cost to get it up into here. You know, because if our crop starts to shrink and everybody gets concerned about availability, they're going to be bidding up stuff coming out of both Brazil and Argentina too. So that doesn't necessarily mean that we'll end up bringing a lot into the southeast. And if we do bring it into the southeast, more likely it'll be somewhere off on in the winter, spring.
Dale Durkles, AgriVisor, continue to sleep soundly.
Don't worry, I do.
It is 73 degrees on a rainy morning at 5 minutes before 6 o'clock here on the Saturday Morning Show. This week, as a matter of fact, yesterday, the National FFA Organization selected 16 students from throughout the United States as finalists for its 2017 Top Achievement Awards. American Star Farmer, American Star in Agribusiness, American Star in Agricultural Placement, and American Star in Agriscience. And here are the 16 that are vying for the Top Star Award in each category. In the American Star Farmer, Joseph Arnold of Minnesota, Nicholas James Vollmer of Colorado, Jake Fanning of Oklahoma, Mark Cavalero of California. The four finalists in the American Star in Agribusiness, Nathan DeYoung of Indiana, Austin Nordic of Kansas, Audra Montgomery of North Dakota, Sean Wenrick of Ohio. The American Star in Agricultural Placement, Matthew Rees, Wisconsin, Devin DeBruhl of Indiana, Kelly May Eink of Iowa, Bailey Wilson of Texas, and the fourth category, American Star in Agriscience, Krista Beck of Ohio, Elizabeth Baker Mikesell of Pennsylvania, Lee Danielle Hefty of Indiana, Lauren Gregory King of Michigan. A panel of judges will review the finalists and select one winner for each award at the 90th National FFA Convention and Expo, October 25 through 28 in Indianapolis. Four winners will be announced during an on-stage ceremony Thursday, October 26. Sponsoring the American FFA Degree Recognition Program, ADM Crop Risk Services, Case IH, Elanco, and Syngenta, all serve as sponsors of the highlight of the awards program, but they have a lot of awards that are passed out at the National FFA Convention, and many of them include college scholarships. A tragedy in Minnesota this week, Eden Valley, Minnesota. A fur trade organization is among two groups offering a total of $11,000 reward for information leading to the arrest of the culprits in the release of about 38,000 mink from a Minnesota farm that led to the death of thousands of the animals. And Stearns County Sheriff Don Goodmanson has said he believes animal rights activists released the mink. Thousands of the mink have died from heat stress and dehydration. Most of the animals that died were young and hadn't been weaned from their mothers. And if you truly like animals, you don't do what somebody did in Minnesota to the Lang family that has been raising mink for four generations. Incidentally, the crime falls under the Federal Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act statute. It's being invested by the Stearns County Sheriff's Office and the FBI. So that's a sad story for the Lang family in Minnesota. And we're about out of time here on the Saturday morning show. We enjoy our get-togethers, and particularly now with county fair season underway. You have the Kane County Fair in St. Charles, Illinois, and next week, we have two county fairs in the Chicago area, the DuPage County Fair in Wheaton, getting underway the 26th. We have the Lake County Fair at Gray's Lake, getting underway July 26th, and the Lee County Fair at Amboy, also getting underway next week on the 27th. And this week, the Kane County Fair in St. Charles coming to a close tomorrow. Thank you for joining us. Thanks to Bob Ferguson for hitting all the right switches at the right time. And thank you for listening to the Saturday Morning Show on Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago and WGNradio.com. And if you're an Amazon Echo user, just say play WGN Radio.
Orion Samuelson keeps you connected to the world of business and agriculture on WGN. Hear his reports weekday mornings on The Steve Cochran Show and during the noon hour on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Plus, catch Orion and Max on Saturday mornings at 5 a.m. only on Chicago's WGN Radio 720.